The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Dr. Jennifer Cleary, filling in for Jonathan McCrae for the next few weeks. You can contact the show. It's science@newstalk.com or we're on Twitter at @NewsTalkScience. On this week's show, we're looking at inherited memories. Now, the experiences of your parents and even your grandparents can be passed on. But coming up first, we're looking at this week's science news with Dr. Lara Dungan and Shane Bergen, physicist and assistant professor in science education at UCD. Thank you very much for joining
us. Thank you for having us today.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Is it weird that I'm in the seat of power?
It's so nice not having Johnny here. He'll never hear this, right? He's in Argentina, so he won't ever.
Because we don't have podcasts.
Radio doesn't go to Argentina.
Or we don't have podcasts or anything like that. Yeah,
fine.
No, it's fine. It's totally fine.
Glorious without him.
Okay, so now we've got our first story. So in case anybody didn't get that, we're definitely implying aliens here. So, Shane.
What is that?
Shane.
Come on. Are you serious?
Really? We thought that you were the one who had seen it. Have you seen it?
I've seen it, but actually it goes pretty downhill after that part. So,
we got it at the right spot. I've never seen it.
Have you?
No, what is it?
Come on.
No, honestly, the mistake that people make between scientists and people who like
and
science
regular
fiction.
Humans.
Yeah, it's like, I hate science fiction.
Okay.
So like, I wouldn't have watched any of
that. I think don't tell him and let him
yeah,
discover
no, I'm gonna, you're a scientist, you can
I like
can
music.
It's pretty relevant to the story you're going to tell.
So our story, talk to us.
Yes,
radios,
I'll tell you about the story.
Aliens.
Okay, so recently some Canadian scientists have noticed for the second time ever very brief, ultra brief, repeating energy bursts from a far off galaxy. These are radio waves. So radio waves are a type of light. It's just our eyes can't see them. So the 106 that News Talk goes out on is a radio wave, and it's a wave of light. And so these are coming, but they're unusual in that they're very, very brief. And there's a repetition to them. There's a frequency to them that is sort of, we haven't got a natural cause for this type of radio wave. We don't know what might be causing it. It may be some extremely powerful astronomical event like a neutron star colliding with a black hole. As happens. But we're not quite sure as to what the cause of these may be. This has led to speculation from other scientists, not those who published the work, that it may be from an alien source. Now, I do stress the people that are making that claim are not those who put out the paper, right?
Okay, there
is no proof given. It's just speculation. They're saying, given that we haven't got a natural explanation for these brief radio waves, they may be alien in nature.
But how possible is this? Like, is this like we see something weird in a cell and somebody goes, aliens? Or is this actually that... It could be because like you say, the pattern to it and how they're coming, it could actually be.
Yes. So the guy from the Smithsonian in the US, probably, well, he's not working at the moment, I guess, with the government shutdown. Maybe this is why he's thinking of this right now, I speculate. But this may be caused by aliens because of the nature of the radio waves, so that they're rapid and they're brief. And so that it looks artificial or it looks created. He did say, though, that the energy required to send these across the galaxy would be enormous, absolutely enormous. So he speculated that this could be a planet-sized propulsion system. So this could be something out there in the far-off cosmos that's producing these bursts, and it's being used, he speculates again, wildly, I should say, this could be a way of propelling spaceships. So you'd send out these bursts and you'd ride the wave, you'd surf them across the cosmos.
That is so cool.
Now, I should stress that the interesting thing is really, like, the science here is that we've discovered a new type of, or not new, but I suppose previously not seen much type of radio wave, and we have to discover, or we have to figure out what may have caused it.
Previously so, not seen much.
Yes.
That was your sentence there. Yeah, hardcore science.
Oh my God. I was still focusing on the surfing. I was like, thank God you brought us back to science. I was like, you're just surfing.
Planet surfing to the cosmos.
Yes, they are previously not seen much, actually.
I love it. Brilliant. Put that in your next paper.
I will.
Okay, Shay, thank you very much. So we're going to go very, very different now. Lara, we've got a story about grey tits. Head out of the gutter, head out of the gutter, the birds.
Oh my God, you've been dying to say that all morning, haven't you?
I have been dying to say that.
We have a story about, and we do, it is a story about grey tits.
Yep.
So, everyone who listens to the show knows that I bang on about climate change all the time because it is really, really important. But this is a kind of a climate change story with a bit of a twist. So there's these type of birds that live in sub-Saharan Africa most of the year, and they're called pied flycatchers. And in around about April, they fly up to the likes of the Netherlands and UK, kind of further north forests, and they eat big, fat, yummy caterpillars. And because of climate change, what's happening is those caterpillars are getting big, fat and yummy earlier in the year. So it means that the pied flycatchers are flying up earlier in the year, so maybe at the end of March. And what's happening is we're getting a bit of a housing crisis. So the great tits, which are a type of what we thought before I read this story were adorable garden birds, hold that thought, are already in their nests. Mm-hmm. And there's only a limited number of nests because they live in holes of trees and woodpeckers need to make those nests for them. So there's a limited amount of nests. They don't make their own
nests. So it's like a rental housing crisis.
Exactly. Okay, it's like the rental crisis rather than the buying crisis.
Yeah.
And what happens is now the pied flycatchers are arriving and the great tits, love it, are still there. They're still in residence. They haven't left because what they do is they have their season, say, in March and then they leave them. And they arrive and the great tits are horrific. So apparently they're quite vicious birds. And if they were the size of lions or tigers, we'd be more terrified of them. They hold down the flycatchers from behind with they've really strong claws, and they repeatedly peck on the same space in the back of their skull until they get all the way through, and then they eat their brains. And this is 100% true, and it's happening. One season it happened to one in every 10 of the flycatching birds, and scientists are going out and they're putting up nesting boxes, but they can't keep up with the amount of the birds that are arriving. And so basically climate change is making great tits peck the brains out of pied flycatchers and eat them for nutrition.
Well, if that doesn't make people change their behaviours, I don't know what. Where is this happening?
It's happening mostly in the Netherlands and UK, those kind of northern forests around Europe. So like it's on our doorstep, basically. So people, stop driving your diesel and your petrol cars, please.
You've actually made me speechless. Like, I know it's radio, disgusting. So people can't see my face, but my jaw is just...
Her jaw did drop, I promise.
The sentence of... Great tits are just pecking the brains out of birds because of a rental crisis.
It's horrific.
Just as it's a sentence.
It kind of touches on everything that's happening in Ireland at the moment, doesn't it?
It does. It's a bit too close to home.
It probably is a bit. We should move on.
We'll move on from that one. Shane, the ocean cleanups plastic catcher, which is shockingly hard to say.
It is, absolutely. It's also, it seems, a complete disaster. So Ocean Cleanup, a private company, raised $40 million to produce a U-shaped catcher. So basically, this is a floating device that is in the ocean. It's somewhere between, it was somewhere between Hawaii and California, an area of the ocean where a lot of plastic coalesces. And this horseshoe-shaped U thing that catches plastic has failed, unsurprisingly perhaps, as you know, part of me thinks they should have listened to all the researchers that said this isn't going to work, the sea is going to cut it up, the sea is quite energetic and it's vicious. Another part of me thinks let them have a go at it, like learn through failure, and that is their own motto, right? Like that kind of Samuel Beckett line of fail better. But I suppose
that's Samuel Beckett,
fail better, exactly.
So I thought Twitter made that up.
In this day and age, you know, it might claim that it did, but yeah, basically this thing has been cut in two by the ocean, and it's been towed now to Hawaii to be repaired. Now there has been, as I mentioned, a lot of concern around this U-shaped device, not just because it doesn't work, but that it might have secondary consequences in that it can endanger sea life. And of course, it's not sufficient to clean up the amount of plastic in our oceans. Yeah. So if we put out things like this, like sweeping brushes effectively out into the ocean to pick up the plastic, we mightn't change our behaviour. So the amount of plastic that we are consuming and disposing of is enormous. We're soon, if we haven't already, reached the point where we'd have more plastic by mass in the sea than we have fish.
That's terrifying. Isn't it? Like, that's just an awful, like...
And it's completely inert. So that means nothing, like, unless you go out there and attack it with chemicals that are going to do other types of damage, or you can physically remove it, it's going to stay there. It might be in micro-sized chunks that will get into the innards of animals, or it can be
that
things...
That we then eat.
Yes, indeed.
Let's not forget.
And this is real. Like, we see this week, Bordy Skiwara, I saw on the news last night, are encouraging fishermen across and fisherwomen out on the coasts of Ireland.
Fisherpersons.
To collect plastic, and they show the amount that they would take in when they trawl for fish. It's enormous, the amount of plastic out there.
The fact that this is broken is unsurprising,
yes.
But also we have to change our behaviour, because there's only so much of this we can do. We can build these, we can try to clean it up, but like you say, if we don't change our behaviour, it's going to end up back in the ocean.
Yeah, there is one cool one that they say, put it at the sources or the mouths of rivers. Mm. And so there's a Mr. Trash Wheel in Baltimore. It cost a fraction of the other one. It's only $500,000 dollars. And it's collecting. It's a big trundle wheel. It collects plastic that's coming out of the river's mouth before it gets into the ocean. That seems like a sensible place to put it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that makes sense. Yeah.
And it has a cool name.
Yeah. Such a cool name. I'm digging the names of things today.
Mr. Anything is going to work, isn't it? Like?
So, Lara, you have a story about AI technology and identifying genetic diseases.
Yeah. So I was actually just saying this morning that I used to not really buy into this, but I work as a doctor, and I do honestly think that in about 50 years, I used to think I was one of the last professions that probably wouldn't be made redundant. But I actually do think that genuinely in about 50 years, we will need only a fraction of the amount of doctors we have now. But this paper does not prove it. Let me just throw that out there now. So a bunch of scientists actually produced a paper that's gone into Nature Medicine, and they've made a machine called Deep Gestalt. And what it does is they fed 17,000 faces in, pictures of faces. This is not as bad as the Great Tits story. Pictures of faces. And those people had around 500 different genetic diseases. And they reckon that 8% of the population has some sort of underlying genetic disease. Now, most of them are quite minor, but some of them are more major, and they can be seen in your facial features. So, for instance, anyone who knows about Down syndrome, there's very specific facial features that are involved. Now, Down syndrome is very easy to diagnose. It's not like some, but others are very difficult. And what they did was they basically, first of all, they asked the machine to look at then 500 different faces and give them their top 10 of what it could be. And in 91% of the time, in the top 10, they identified the actual disease. And then they pitted them against humans, as scientists are wont to do. And there was a disease called Noonan syndrome, which is quite rare. And the facial features are very subtle. And only in about 20% of the time, the doctors were able to pick it out. But the machine was able to pick it out 64% of the time. Now, I'm not sure how applicable this is, because a lot of genetic diseases are actually readily identified, yeah, especially with the, you know, scientific and laboratory experiments. But sometimes they're not. So I can actually see why, you know, in a more subtle disease, maybe feeding faces through these AI tech, especially if it doesn't hurt, if it's not very expensive, you know, why not?
Absolutely. But kind of to what end? So if you're going to have to get the genetic testing done, if there's this out there, isn't there then the whole thing of people are going to start using your face against you?
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's
terrifying.
It's ethically very challenging. What's to stop an employer? You come in and they're going to scan your face. It's like your face recognition software is a thing, right? And they go, Lara has these things. Is she a high risk employee or a low risk employee?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, or for health insurance.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I hadn't even thought about that one. It's terrifying. And to be honest, there's nothing to stop that happening. And I mean, like, the question is everywhere at the moment, what's to stop any of it? I mean, you know, they're making genetically modified babies or a baby in China, you know, so in general.
Do you know what can stop it? Is doctors like you saying no. And so, like, you have a power as an individual.
Right,
I'm
saying no.
You know, you're an expert, so you just say no. Like, as a profession, you said this is not
right. It's very
right.
hard, though. There's countries in the world where it won't be regulated. And once it's made there, how do we stop it? Like, honestly, it terrifies me.
You can do it, Lara.
Thanks, buddy.
So we got a few texts in. So Shane, this one is towards you. Although, Lara, if you can answer it.
I'm going to weigh in, whatever it is.
Space.
Space. The last radio wave heard like this turned out to be the microwave in the ISS. Is it possible it's something that simple? That's in from Peter.
Oh, the actual microwave.
Like the cooking device.
Wow. Okay, that's very cool.
This is a text in from Peter. I don't claim any part of this being fact. This is a text that
that's
we have
gas.
Gotten.
Yeah. All texts that come into this show are factual.
All texts that come in are, you know, not
my
own.
She's inside writing them out right now. We know she's doing it.
Well, that's very interesting. And I suppose the process is to figure out what it might be. But we don't say that it is something until we have scientific proof or evidence to say it is something.
Yeah. Except planet surfing aliens, which is clearly what we stated about 10 minutes ago.
Did we actually say that?
I believe that's what you you said. I think you again, said we can't listen back. This is radio, right? There's no way to listen back to this. So.
You definitely said the word speculation, I'd say about 17 times.
Okay.
So yeah. We're fine. We got another text in. The correct term for a person who engages in the fishing is a fisher.
Oh,
okay.
This is another, again,
and
text.
Also, not to be mean, but they shouldn't be off the hook because they actually produce a huge amount of the plastic waste that in the ocean.
Was that a pun off the hook?
Oh my God, it wasn't. It actually wasn't. I'm so funny.
Okay, so if anybody likes to text in and just knock Lara back down there.
Off my pedestal.
Just knock her off the pedestal. We got another text. Remember Wally, the kids' cartoon movie? Who would have thought about the ocean plastics? I haven't seen it.
I've only seen the first half and it was very sad, so I stopped. Apparently it gets amazing in the second half and I need to go back to it.
Okay, I'm going to go home and watch this. Guys, thank you so much. This is Dr. Lara Dungan and Dr. Shane Bergen. Thank you so much for coming in and joining me. I loved the puns and all the hilarious names. Coming up next, we've got inherited memories, how the experiences of previous generations may be passed on. Now, we all know we inherit certain traits from our parents, grandparents and beyond. Hair colour, height, the shape of your nose, or even what diseases you may battle during your lifetime. But what if the life experiences of those who have gone before you are passed on as well? And what if we were able to turn the effects of those experiences on and off? Dr. Oded Rachavi is Associate Professor at Tel Aviv University's Faculty of Life Sciences and Segal School of Neuroscience. He joins me now. Dr. Rachavi, thank you very much for being on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
So first off, what is epigenetics?
Well, there are many definitions and the term has been abused a little bit because people sometimes say epigenetics instead of saying gene regulation. But when we say epigenetics, we mean changes that persist after cell division or more interestingly across generations, which are not mediated by changes to the DNA sequences, but they are transmitted through other means, through other molecules.
And we use the term inherited memories or genetic memories. So what do you mean by genetic memories exactly?
Well, by inherited memories, I mean that in certain organisms, that it's not clear, I'm sure we'll talk about it, it's not clear that it is happening in humans, but in simple organisms, it has been shown, and we study this as well, that certain life experiences can transmit across generations and persist even in the progeny that did not directly experience the same experiences, only because the parents did or the grandparents.
So if, say, my grandparents had gone through a stage of extreme poverty, their experience would have changed. They would have switched on certain mechanisms to help them deal with maybe hunger, and then that could be passed all the way down to me.
Right. The problem is that in humans, it's very hard to differentiate between the different factors that could contribute to such effects. Which is why it's still extremely controversial. And some studies did claim that it also in humans, starvation, for example, the example that you gave, can produce heritable changes, but it's not clear yet. The proofs are still relatively weak, but in some organisms, especially in very simple organisms such as nematodes or worms, it has been shown exactly that when you starve these worms, then it lasts a trace, a memory also in the next generations. And they, as a result, can respond better to additional periods of starvation, and they can also live longer. And in these simple organisms, we are getting into the mechanism. We're starting to learn how this is happening, and we know that it can't happen because of changes to the DNA, because inheritance through DNA just doesn't work like that. There are alternative mechanisms that maybe can explain how this is happening. And this is exciting because then we can learn about it, and it can improve our diagnosis, assuming that it does happen in humans, which, as I say, remain to be seen. And if we can do that, then we can improve our diagnosis and also perhaps prevent these harmful changes when they are harmful.
And so you're saying you're looking at the mechanism now in small, like worms or nematodes. So have you got any hint of how it does work, what the science is behind it?
Yes. So there are many, many studies. Many people are studying this. And I think that in worms, which are really the best organism for studying this thing now, because the advantage of worms is they make lots of babies and their generation time is very short. So very quickly you can look at many generations and lots of offspring. So you get the statistics and rigor. And in these organisms, we have shown that these inherited memories are passed across generations, not by changes to the DNA, but by changes to other molecules which are called RNAs or more specifically, small RNAs. And we now know that there's a dedicated mechanism that works completely different and independently than the inheritance, that the mechanism that transmits chromosomes and DNA across generations, that in these simple worms transmits small RNAs between generations, and there's a mechanism for amplifying these things so they won't dilute very quickly across generations. And there's a very elaborate and complex pathway that regulates this small RNA-based inheritance, which affects gene expression and then controls the physiology of the next generation, so it will be very precise and wouldn't get out of hand.
So you said there that they don't get diluted over, you know, a few generations. Did you have any idea of how many generations it was before you stopped seeing the effects?
Right, yes. So we and also many others have seen that when you, for example, when you start an epigenetic effect like that in the worm, the effect typically lasts for 3 to 5 generations. And it wasn't clear what is this magical number and how the worms count to 5 or to 3. And what we've shown is that there's this sort of a feedback mechanism that shuts down inheritance after 3 to 5 generations. And this is could be of some adaptive value. It could help them perhaps calibrate it so they won't stay fixed, because you want this to be a temporary change. But we also found mutants, worms that have some genes affected, where the effects just don't stop. This timer is broken, and as a result, the memory persists indefinitely, or at least in worms' time indefinitely, so tens of generations, many tens of generations even. So you just forget to forget, if you wish.
I understand, yeah. So when that happens, when it is passed on and you're in within this 3 to 5 generations, if you put, say it was, like you said, that they were starved in the previous generations, if you feed mm-hmm. the worm, you know, enough food, does their offspring then, does it reverse? Like, does it go back? Does it switch on and off that quickly? Or does it persist for that 3 to 5 generations before it's then switched off?
So changing them to placing them back on food doesn't erase the mechanism. That doesn't erase the inheritance. To get the inheritance erased at the moment, how to do it just by exposing them to another environment is still a mystery. We're studying this, but it's not clear yet. But we can do it genetically. We can manipulate certain genes that we know are responsible for this inheritance, so it would last longer, or that it would stop immediately. We identified these genes. We call them MOTEC genes. MOTEC in Hebrew means sweetheart, but the acronym is modified transgenerational epigenetic kinetics. Very complicated. But in these mutants, the inheritance just lasts longer, and we know how this is happening mechanistically. At the biological level, but we still don't know how the environment erases inheritance or how it makes it to last longer.
And we did touch on humans. So you're saying we don't know whether this happens in humans, because there's, like you say, there's been a lot of controversy. People do throw around the term epigenetics an awful lot.
Right. So there are two things to say here. First of all, the term is abused. So people say epigenetics about everything. You know, epigenetic yoga and whatever. But real epigenetic inheritance in humans is hard to study, and there are some better and better attempts also in other, you know, more complicated organisms than worms, like mice and other rodents. But what has been shown is that, for example, there's this famous case of the hunger in the Netherlands, the Dutch famine, where people were starved during the Second World War, and there were some effects that last till for two generations. But in these studies, it's not truly epigenetic inheritance, because the mother was starved while the baby was already in her she was pregnant,
and also, I understand.
So the baby was directly affected, and also since the baby already had germ cells, you can say that two generations down the road were affected directly. Only when you go to another generation, you can truly talk about an epigenetic effect, because then you're looking at progeny that were not exposed to the original stress. And there are some things that suggest that this is happening also, but this is still very early, and we have no mechanistic clue of how this is happening. But it's very interesting. It should be studied, of course.
Of course. So that makes a lot of sense, because I guess that has really, like you say, that the term has been abused, epigenetics, because in that the woman was already pregnant. So the baby was in that environment. It's not just that it was passed down through the generations. The baby was also being starved. Well, the fetus was being starved at that time.
Right, right. And there are other studies that suggest that there are true epigenetic memories being passed. For example, in Sweden, smokers, grandparents that smoked were suggested to transfer effects to the grandchildren. So this is the sperm and it's two generations, you can say that it's true epigenetic inheritance, but still, these studies are also controversial and not clear mechanistically. I think it's promising and very interesting, but I wouldn't say it's the ultimate proof now that we're looking for. I mean, now that you see what's happening in genetics, in normal, you know, DNA-based genetics, now people are studying many thousands of people and doing all the proper controls because we have so many people sequencing their DNA, so we can do it much better. In epigenetics, we're just getting there. I'm hopeful that in the future we'll get to the same rigor that is now standard in genetic analysis, but I think we'll get there. I think it's just much harder to distinguish between, you know, nature and nurture, and also to understand what we're dealing with, since the mechanisms are still being revealed and so complicated and new.
It really is one of those. It's fascinating, the distinctions between them. I guess I wasn't even sure, and I'm a qualified biochemist, I wasn't sure about the distinction between the inherited there with the true epigenetics versus, you know, what we just call gene regulation. That's fascinating. So so your work was in worms. Are you going to continue to look at it in humans to see if it's also these small RNAs, or is somebody else going to take on this research now?
I don't have any plans to do it now, but I'd be happy to collaborate. I mean, I'm not an epidemiologist, but I think I'm more in the basic science part of, you know, understanding the mechanisms in simple organisms. But I might find myself studying this with collaborators in the future, but that's not in my immediate plans.
Dr. Rajavi, thank you so much. If anybody's listening and would like to collaborate with Dr. Rajavi and bringing this study into humans, please get in touch. Dr. Rajavi, that was fascinating. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
I'm Dr. Jennifer Cleary, filling in for Jonathan McCrae, and I've been given the task looking at last week's texts that we got in. Now, any anger was directed towards Jonathan, if we can just remember that. So any angst here, I wasn't here, this is all directed to Jonathan. So last week's show was, a big part of it was I think, therefore I think I am. It was talking about perceptions. And so one of the texts we got in was from Hugh in Cork. He said, how about the ultra reality of everyday work, especially those at the high end, i.e. surgeons or indeed Navy SEALs? No imagining here. Ask the question, exactly why are we as academics obsessed with theory, illusion and perception, even though in the first world we are so far away from Darwinism because of medicine and protective warfare? Well, I think first of all here, I get what you're saying, that you're saying that surgeons can't be imagining if they're like open the human body, they can't be imagining what a kidney looks like. They can't perceive something different to a different surgeon. But I think that what we were saying last week was that because of their training, they would create the same data abstract structures. So instead of looking and every surgeon sees something different, they all see the same thing because their training has told them to do that. And the same with the Navy SEALs. And they create the reality because it's quicker for them to do it. Rather than having to see everything, they can create through their perception and their study what they're looking at. Why are academics obsessed with theory, illusion, perception? Is that not an academic's job? I used to be an academic. That's what we do. We love theory. You have to have people that think differently. You don't know what comes out of it. And that's the beauty. That's the beauty of the world. Another text we got in, is this just not how things exist in the quantum world? Nothing really exists except through our own perception. I mean, I don't know. I'm not a philosophy major. I'm a biochemist. This, although very fascinating, does go a bit over my head. I mean, you're right. This is what we're talking about. You're talking about the experience of a table, that it's a, you know, it's a data structure you're creating because of what you've seen and your experiences. Is this just not how things exist in the quantum world? I don't know. I can't answer that question. Another one we got, how we create what we see. Okay, what about eyewitness reports? Do all court cases have to be thrown out, open the prisons? That's from Tom H. Oh, that's a bit extreme. I mean, I think that away from this, they have talked about eyewitness reports not being the most reliable. There's been decades of studies done on eyewitness reports, maybe not being the most reliable. It depends on your age, your bias, the race of you, the race of the perpetrator. There's a whole lot that goes into that. But no, I don't believe we should just open the prisons. But I also don't believe that everybody in prison is in prison on one person's eyewitness report. So we have text then about the free will. doesn't this idea of our choices being predetermined seem very Minority Report-esque? On the flip side, you could lock people up before they make these predetermined choices. That's from Fiona. So I've never seen Minority Report. My producer tells me that this is exactly what they did, that they locked people up. But having listened to the show last week, they're talking about how everything makes a choice. Like, it could be your blood sugar level on that day. So how can you decide what somebody is predetermined to do? They're just saying that maybe in the moment you didn't have free will, but everything leading up to that moment determined what you were going to do. Not from three generations ago, I knew I'd be sitting in this studio doing this radio show. And then about the slow motion effect, I was in a car crash 3 years ago and still vividly remember the moment before impact. Felt as if we were doing 50 kilometers an hour when we were driving at 100 kilometers an hour. I'll never forget seeing the other car smash into us. Very interesting topic. Love the show. I'm very sorry that that happened to you. I hope that the results from that is that you are okay now. It's true. I mean, I think we've all experienced that, isn't it? That moment before something really tragic or something that will stay with you, you do remember it. Love the show. I'm going to take credit for that. I know you said all the angst was directed towards Jonathan, but I'm here answering that. So thank you. Thank you very much for loving the show. I really appreciate it. If you want to make a comment or get in touch with the show, it's science@newstalk.com or we're on Twitter at @newstalkscience. Tune in next week for more Future Proof, where I'll be back again.